the people of sake actually brought me into sake.
Back in 1988, this place was actually in Ginza on the main drag.
At first, it was kind of soy sauce. It was miso.
To the point where it actually changed my life.
New Year's Day, 1989.
Not just sake as a beverage, but all the culture and history.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Sake on Air, the world's first podcast dedicated to exploring and expanding the dialogue around Japan's iconic beverages, sake and shochu. Recorded normally at the Japan Sake and Shochu Information Center in the heart of Tokyo, but for this episode, we'll be recording via Zoom. My name is Chris Hughes, and I'm joined today by your regular hosts here on the show, Justin Potts and Sebastian Lemoine. Justin, Sebastian, how are you doing?
Hi, Chris. Good evening.
Good evening.
I think we couldn't be further from recording in the JSS Information Center.
Yeah. We're all in different parts of the world.
We got Japan, US, UK all going. Somehow we made those three time zones work this time, which I didn't think was going to happen, but life is strange and here we are. So, and yeah, I'm here too, but I feel like death. And we've actually tried to record this a couple times, but I continue to feel like death. So I'm going to try to speak as little as possible this time around, but I may contribute a little bit here and there. So
sounds great. And I'm in London, in a hotel in London, recording this, just about to fly back to Tokyo. I've been back in the UK visiting family. Nice to spend Christmas with family.
Nice.
Not done that in absolutely ages. And I got my mom into sake. So result.
There you go. There you go. Big win.
How did you do that? Yeah. Did you get a special sake in front of her?
She asked me to bring back a couple of bottles of some sake to try. And we tried it with our Christmas dinner and various other meals that we had. And she's just fallen in love with it. It's Junmai Daiginjo from a particular brand in Yamagata Prefecture, a brand I worked for a little while. And she loves it. Yeah, it's different from wine. She did comment that it tastes a lot more spirit-like, which was interesting, but I think it's growing on her. And I think she's also appreciating how it changes at different temperatures as well. So I'm quite chuffed.
I thought you would have designed a special sake for her.
Next time. Good idea.
Next time. I think that's in relation with...
I see what you're trying to do there, Sebastian. I'm a bit slow on the mark, but that is a very clever way of segueing into this episode's topic, which is basically design your own sake.
Yeah, basically contract manufacturing of sake is kind of what we're getting into.
Yeah.
The reason we kind of wanted to touch on this is because it's just becoming incredibly more common in recent years. The number of people, places, entities that are out creating opportunities to create their own private labels and contract manufacture with breweries, not only in Japan but outside of Japan, to do all sorts of different types of labels and collaborations and whatnot, has just become the number is just too vast to keep track of. And so obviously you're seeing a lot of this in other, you know, beverage and spirit industries. Every celebrity has their own whiskey or something nowadays. It's by no means anything new, but we thought it's something that might be worth being addressed when it comes to sake, because the opportunities that are out there on some occasions are also available not only to, you know, large corporations or organizations that have, you know, a huge financial interest in it, but there are also some interesting opportunities that pop up where, you know, individuals or special occasion types of things can come in and create these opportunities as well. And so we thought it would be just worth addressing sort of a little bit of the history of sort of contract manufacturing or contract brewing in Japan as it relates to sake, and then bring up maybe a few case examples. We'll just kind of work through that concept here for a half hour or so.
So I think probably the best thing to do is to start by explaining the terminology, the common terminology that's used for this contract made sake. The commonly used terms in Japan are OEM, which is original equipment manufacturer. And then we also have a private brand, which is abbreviated as PB, or sometimes also it's called private label. And basically, we're talking about sake, which is commissioned by a private entity to be made for them, or perhaps it's an existing sake and the company just wants to put their own label on the bottle or even design the bottle. It does vary. There are different variations of this contract-made sake. And there are some other different types of private brand sake. So you've got white label, where the contractor designs their own label, but the sake is an existing product. So that's the simplest form of personal brand sake. And then you have completely bespoke, made-to-order sake, where everything from the ingredients to the techniques that are used to the people in the brewery are specified by the private contractor. And then you also have collaborations where basically the brewery and the private entity work together to produce a product. So it's more of a kind of a half and half kind of split between investment and sort of time and how much the private entity is actually involved in the brewing process itself.
Yeah, I'd say the collaboration can vary. Kind of the mileage of collaboration can vary, I guess, right? There's
Yeah.
it's to what degree does it go beyond merely a financial transaction, right? How many different types of parties are involved and what is their level of involvement? I like that you brought up the idea of specifying the people involved in the brewing, because that's actually a big part of it nowadays, is they want someone from their organization or the person who's, contracting it. They want them to physically be there for, some part of the process in the production or something like that. And so, that level of collaboration can be very different. Or when you're working with a high profile artist or with a specific brand, to what degree are they actually involved in the development of it versus merely, providing a name for the label, and so that range of collaboration can really vary.
Yeah, and it's not only about control, it's about acquiring new skills, both for the brewery and for the people who are not brewers who come to join the brewery for a while. So that's the beauty of it when that
Sure.
happens.
And that's probably, like I said, we'll talk about that in a minute, but that's probably one of the more common, I guess, scenarios that you're starting to see more and more, is a lot of the people that are contracting the brewing from the sake maker are ones who actually have an intention to produce sake themselves in the future in some capacity. So part of the reasoning for working with them to create that thing is not just to create a one-off product, but to actually better understand the process, as well as use the thing that comes of that contract manufacturing to start building the brand that they then have to leverage to help get them into having the financial means to get into production, and then also have sort of the built-in marketplace for their product before they make that larger investment. So.
And there, I mean, we can refer our listeners to a couple of episodes that we recorded at Sake on Air, and there is one in particular that comes to my mind after what you just explained, Justin. It's the Adachi
Sure.
Nojo episode 101, which is the history of Adachi-kun and how he created his new brewery and his period of building skills and building confidence in what he wanted to do. I mean, originally he wanted to become an Olympic swimmer, and now he's a farmer and craft sake brewer. So what an evolution.
Anyone.
Yeah, I'd encourage listeners to go listen to go check that one out, because it's a really great story.
And I think the big question, of course, that will be on our listeners' minds, and it was on our minds when we actually approached this topic, is why is there so much private brand sake out there? Why is there so much contract made sake out there? And how did the industry get to this sort of point. So I did research a little bit of the history, you know, as I like to. And some of our listeners may already be familiar. I don't know if we've brought up these terms in previous episodes before, but there are two terms which are quite important when we talk about the history, Oke Uri and Oke Gai, which is basically OEM sake in a nutshell. It's a Japanese word which kind of means buying from or selling to a brewery. And basically what would happen, I think it started around the Edo period. I got that information from an interview with Kenbishi. It was an interview between them and one of the small breweries that they used to sell, they used to buy sake from. The way it would work is basically the big breweries eventually reached capacity. They could no longer make any more sake. They didn't have enough tanks to do it, but also a law was put in place at some point, I think at the end of the war, Second World War.
1937.
1937, thank you very much. I even put that in my notes, didn't I? And it basically, it told brewers how much they could make, and they weren't allowed to make over that limit. So around that time, demand was really starting to pick up. And the concern was that if they didn't make more sake, the sake industry would turn into what the whiskey industry in Japan has turned into, a premium market with people just inflating the prices. So the solution to make more sake was very simply to start asking smaller breweries to make the sake for them. So they would commission a sake brewery, a smaller sake brewery, not always smaller sake brewery, but most of the case, smaller sake brewery. That brewery would make sake, send it to the bigger brewery. The bigger brewery would then blend it or turn it into a product, put a label on, and sell it as their own brand. So it's a kind of OEM, not strictly OEM. But the reason why I bring this up is because this Oke Uri, Oke Gai practice actually ended pretty much when sake demand started to fall. The breweries no longer had to make that much sake, and so they stopped contracting the smaller breweries. And this left a vacuum of tanks, basically empty tanks in the breweries. And the breweries had to find a way to fill these tanks to make money. So it's possible. I don't think it's the only reason that this type of private brand contract-made sake came about. But I think it certainly had a sort of an influence. It started the evolution towards this contract-made sake era that we're in at the moment. And by the way, I did find out the first ever, I think this is the first ever contract-made sake, or cooperative sake, as it's called. It's called Nichi no Utage, and that was made in 1971, and you can actually still buy it in Japan. It's a futsushi.
So yeah, so I mean, I guess, so that's sort of the, I guess a brief background of sort of where this is coming from. And basically you have, not only did the Oke Uri, Oke Gai practice disappear, just general demand for sake decreased drastically. And a lot of the sake breweries now in Japan are making, say, roughly a third of what they used to make or so when they're at capacity. That will obviously vary by brewery, but in general, probably about a quarter to a third of what they at one time produced, which means they're clearly, and the price of sake hasn't gone up a whole heck of a lot in the last several decades either. So the amount that they're actually producing and selling is significantly less than what it used to be, and they need to make and sell more sake. So they're keen to do so. Yep. So the idea of something like this, doing a private label or making sake or providing sake for someone as sort of a contract manufacturer, could be appealing in some scenarios, because the sake market in Japan has been contracting for a while, and a lot of breweries don't necessarily have the marketing resources or the other tools, skills, know-how in order to go out and create something entirely new for, you know, new market development. And so as the idea of this added value to both sake and agricultural products is something that people are really focusing on, you know, a lot more of these opportunities are starting to present itself. And so now it's becoming sort of up to the discretion of the brewery to decide whether or not they want to take part in these different types of practices. And depending on who it is that's bringing the conversation, the terms and the nature of that could be very, very different. Sort of like Chris, what you mentioned, like with the collaboration and whatnot, that definition of collaboration is very different to different individuals, right? I mean, this is true in everything outside of just manufacturing. You know, when a group of people get together to collaborate on something, right, what that means could be a could be interpreted very differently by everyone involved, and sort of what that role is. In a perfect scenario, it's very mutually beneficial to both parties or to all parties involved, right? Whether it be the combination of the grower, the brand, the company or entity that's spearheading or sponsoring it, to the brewery, to the manufacturer. In an ideal scenario, right, everybody is on board, looking out for everyone's best interests, and they are working toward a shared goal that where everybody wins in the end, right? This is not always the case. There
No.
are some really, really fantastic examples of these, but for every, you know, shining example that we hear, the reality is there's probably another 10 or a dozen that you didn't hear about, or they got started and kind of petered out, which is why a lot of breweries are also they're hesitant to jump into a lot of these contract manufacturing sort of relationships, because there's that opportunity for immediate sales. But you know, in order to obviously produce or make something, it requires a significant investment of time and energy and resources, possibly equipment, depending on the scale and whatnot. Especially if it's you're working with an unknown party. You know, you don't know how big this thing's going to get or how committed they are to seeing that through. So, it's a challenge, and it's a decision that breweries don't make lightly, or hopefully they don't.
Maybe not the first
Right?
time, but after the first
Sure.
time, they learn from their shortfalls and try to get a better return the next time around.
Absolutely.
I think the biggest merit that comes to my mind is that if you want to approach a new audience, if you want to create a new market, it's very difficult for sake breweries to do this normally because they only make so much sake. They have to make sure that all their regular customers get their allotted amount of sake. They can't suddenly just take a batch of their existing sake and sell it to a complete new market. It's very difficult to do that. And also, there's risk involved if you create a new product, if it doesn't sell, right? And how can you really know if it's going to sell before you actually make it? Of course, you can do market research, you can do a search, maybe sampling, but it's not really done in the sake industry, and it's very difficult to do because the sake industry, at the end of the day, it's quite a low price product, right? So essentially, a lot of investment is required for very little return. And so breweries have been very hesitant historically, I think, about making new products. We're only seeing this explosion of new products in the market in recent times because new markets are appearing. So I think the biggest merit really has got to be that someone else comes along to take on the burden of that risk and basically says, if it doesn't sell, it's not your problem. You make the sake. We'll worry about the sales part, designing the label, picking the audience, making sure that we've got the right target audience, etc. Just make the sake for us. That's all you have to do. If we're a brewer, I mean, why would you not do it? That's a massive, massive merit in my opinion.
That's especially true for the export market or all the markets where the breweries don't have a presence yet. So they don't know the consumers, they don't know the cultural ways of consuming or selling sake. It clearly looks like a win-win in this situation. But
Yeah.
this may apply to the Japanese market, to the Japanese Nihonshu market as well, doesn't it?
Yes. Yeah. They don't have the time as well to go out and explore these new markets. So, to have another company that maybe is more experienced and has more, a better skill set to do that, it just makes a lot of sense. And so that I think has to be the biggest merit. But there are others.
Yeah, I mean, it can be you know, a real the opportunity to try new techniques or styles or something like that. You can sort of which is neat, because it's again, it's an opportunity to do that with slightly less risk. Obviously, whoever's contracting for them, you could, if you're doing something for the first time or something you're not super experienced in, and the thing that you turn over is not what they would expect, obviously there's risk involved in that. But it's an opportunity to learn without having to necessarily take on the burden of the cost of all the raw materials and all the things associated with that product or that thing you're making. So it's a chance to explore and develop is definitely a good opportunity.
And you don't sacrifice your existing customer base because it's not targeted at
them.
Sure. And it doesn't dilute your existing market that you have with them. But that's really important for a lot of the bigger breweries, actually.
Absolutely, absolutely.
What we see a lot in the market is premium products that come to the market through a PB or private label, in a private label shape. And I think this is good, because we have that discussion about the fact that the price of sake has not risen much, and sake is still seen as a low price product. But for some of these new sake coming out, the price range is really much higher, and overall it just contributes to putting sake on the map of alcoholic beverages in a different price range.
And that's because you can add value that you can't do with the normal kind of brewery lineup. You can add value that gives you a reason to charge a little bit more. So yeah, a much more free pricing model is a massive merit of contract-made sake, I think.
And if you do have a good partnership or good relationship, ideally that partner is somebody, the thing they're contracting you for, they're, as a business, they're hopefully trying to grow and develop it, which means that it should ostensibly be a constant and potentially constantly growing revenue stream. Again, that's best case scenario.
Yeah. So it's not all good, is it?
Not necessarily.
There are some demerits. The first one I would point out, I think, is that it's often unclear which brewery produced the sake. Now, of course, this does depend on the type of partnership. I'm sure this is discussed before the product goes to market. Can we put the brewery name on the label? Can you put our name on the label? Or, you know, or maybe the private entity actually asks the brewery, would you like us to put your name on the label? Anyway, that should be discussed during the contract. But what I see more than often is that it's very difficult to tell which brewery has made that particular private brand sake. And so it kind of detaches a little bit from the identity of the product.
And more than anything, I guess that it's the additional risk that's involved then, is if the consumer doesn't know where that thing is that they're coming from, one, it doesn't necessarily lead them to find yes. other products. And then two, if that thing doesn't play out, then they don't really have that to leverage anymore. It's not like you don't hear too many places going back and saying, we were the ones who made that thing you loved when it existed. You know, that's not really... It's not the most, you know, effective, you know, means of getting people excited about your product or your other product. So there's that risk involved in that you kind of remain behind the curtain as part of the process. Yes, there's the additional sales for as long as that thing continues. But in the event that it doesn't work out, along with the product, your name never existed in the first place, so you don't necessarily benefit from that notoriety.
In general, it involves a certain investment by the brewery. I mean, it's about understanding the project. It's about thinking about the product should be designed or produced if it's a different sake. It involves sometimes changes on the bottling chain because the format of the bottle is different, the labeling process. So it's not always neutral. It's not about selling something that is existing in an existing tank.
And I think it can also be a merit not to have the brewery name on there, because then it allows restaurants or shops or whoever is commissioning this sake to compete with other restaurants and shops who may be carrying the regular line of that brewery, right? So you might have sake from that brewery, but the, as far as the consumer is concerned, they're completely different products. They're completely unique products. And as far as your competitors are concerned as well, that might be able to push that case.
Yeah, I guess another, it's not necessarily a negative, but it can be a challenge, is that in developing something like that completely from scratch, it's not just a single product of your own. It's something that's could quite possibly be on a completely different trajectory, especially if it's for a new market or a new place. So it's really difficult to gauge how much product will be needed and when. So obviously a lot of times you'll discuss the terms of that, say, hey, we'll make, you know, this entire lot, and then who's responsible for holding on to that product, or, you know, or when is that going to go out into the world, and when do they need more, and whatnot. The challenge is not knowing if and when and how much there will be more needed. Like there's, and kind of Sebastian, yeah, as you were saying, a lot of times, a lot of these things come along with requiring significant other investments, other additional equipment or processes or time are needed in order to accommodate the requests. These aren't necessarily tools or resources that fit smoothly into the production process. And so when you have something that is unpredictably all of a sudden in more volume at a very random, unpredictable period of time, all of a sudden you're required to fit that into an already tight production schedule for, you know, the other product that you're already deeply invested in. That can be challenging as well.
I think a big demerit for me personally, where I'm not always such a fan of this private brand sake thing, is that could it actually do more harm to the image of sake than good in some situations. Just that sort of gimmicky, kind of tacky image that some private brand sake can have, unintentionally, I think, just the way that they're going about it. And it just ends up being that way. But it doesn't project quite the right image that you want to project, or a contradictory image about sake to people. And in a market that's already very confusing for the consumer, I just wonder if having so many products is really such a good thing in the long term.
Yeah, no, it's tricky. So that's, ideally, they'd be in a position to where they, you know, they could choose whether or not they're on the same page as the person that or entity that's, you know, contracting with them. They say, hey, this is something that we can be excited about. But the reality is there are a lot of breweries that could really just use the extra sales. And so they're relatively willing to take on, yeah, some of these things, assuming it's within, you know, within their means. And so, and I think maybe different from possibly some other beverage industries, I'm not entirely sure, but there's a lot of contract manufacturing going to a lot of very, very small producers in Japan, as opposed to just the ones that have the larger built-in capacity and more resources. You've got a lot of places that are going to breweries that are very, very small and do not have a lot of the resources or the means to, you know, again, this is part of the merit. They don't have the means to go out in the world and create these new products, to go out into new places and create new markets for themselves either. But at the same time, they're not necessarily in a strong position to say no. And anybody who comes along with a suggesting that they're able to boost their sales, you know, it sounds like a nice conversation, but the nature of how it's handled then out in the world isn't always fantastic. So there's that risk involved. And a lot of times it's the producers that are already in a relatively weak position to begin with is I guess what makes it hard. Those that are in a stronger position to make more calculated decisions and allocate more resources toward these types of products, surprise, surprise, tend to more often than not have put more meaningful things out into the world.
On this topic of investment from the breweries, I mean, I was fascinated when I visited Kikusoi last year or so, because they've built an additional kura, actually a small lab, where they invite their retailers or some of the restaurants they've been working with to do what we're talking about, to come and experience sake brewing, or to come and design a particular label for themselves. And again, coming back to this idea of exchanging skills and building up the skill base of all those involved in the sake industry, I thought that was a great and very interesting effort. And Nagai-san in Gunma is doing that as well now. They created their own lab to invite their trusted partners to build their own sake. And actually, I used the word trust here, and I want to develop a little bit on this concept, because we have many different situations as we all agree. We have these situations where somebody contacts a small brewery just out of the blue and is looking for a manufacturer, somebody who is going to produce a sake relatively cheap for them. But at the other end of the spectrum, we have sort of this evolution where a trusted retailer, a trusted restaurant chain is working on a particular product, a particular label. I guess in this situation, everything goes out much more smoothly.
Definitely.
Yeah, that must be the case. I would definitely think that would be the case.
Yeah, maybe this is a good time to kind of touch upon kind of a few examples of what some of these good examples look like. Because I said Sebastian sort of touched on that concept of trust and whatnot. Probably the safest and most common scenario that a lot of breweries will wholeheartedly engage in are those where a lot of quality retailers and wholesalers of sake in Japan will work together with the breweries that they sell to carry a very specific, unique iteration, maybe of a pre-existing product that would only be available through that retailer or through that distributor. So, for example, it might be the only Nama version of a certain type of sake that's more readily available. The only Nama that they put out is through that particular distributor. Or, you know, they never do they make a Nigori version of a certain type of sake, but they'll make a few hundred bottles for this specific wholesaler. And that's the only place you can get that. And so that's very, very common. And usually it's the nice thing about that is they're already working with someone they can trust who has developed over time a good working relationship, demonstrating that how they handle and carry and sell and promote their products. And so that level of trust is already built in. And they also know their products. So a lot of times, the unique products that come from that are available specifically through those retailers or wholesalers, a lot of times they're pretty darn good because they're working very closely with the brewery and really kind of hand selecting and really creating something special. And at least I know, like for me, as much as I have sake breweries I like, I also have sake retailers or wholesalers that I like as well too. And so I know that if that retailer or if that distributor has selected a certain brand or has selected to carry a certain sake, chances are it's pretty darn good. I mean, that's how I approach beverage categories that I don't know a whole lot about. It's a whole lot easier to remember when you find something good, look at the back, figure out where did this come from, who's carrying this, and start making those mental notes of who's making the stuff that I like. That sort of approach will help you find a lot of really unique, really great sake through different retailers and sellers as well.
It influences my decision. I mean, I see myself in front of the, I mean, in I'm thinking of a particular store that I love, Suzuki-san store, and there are so many products I want to try. And when Suzuki-san comes and say, oh, you know, this is my this is this this I made had made specially for me, and then this is the only like nigori version of this particular sake. It does influence my decision, and I will go for that one.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, it's a sign of somebody doing good work, and it's one that's built on, trust and a good relationship.
So in our classification will be a sort of a win-win, low risk
Yep, and it
situation, wouldn't
often
it?
results in pretty high quality
Yeah.
product.
Yes, sometimes it involves much more risk. And if we start from the other end of the product design, we wanted to highlight a few examples where we start from the rice. One of the inspiring visits that I made a few, I mean, maybe 2 years ago now, was with Yoshida-san from Koshi no Megumi. Koshi no Megumi, actually, he's a corporation that was formed by a few rice farmers in the Fuchu district in Toyama. And back a few years ago, that about 10 years ago now, they were extremely worried as Japan was negotiating this TPP, this Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, with the US and other countries. And they were really fearful of the possibility that cheap rice would be imported into Japan and it would threaten their livelihood. And so they decided collectively as farmers to, continuing rice, of course, but do a high value rice, and they chose sake rice. They chose Yamada Nishiki and started to produce excellent Yamada Nishiki in Toyama. And not only to do that, but to go down the chain and sell it as sake. And so, of course, the only option available to them was to find a local partner. And they produced the rice, built a rice polishing unit, which, by the way, today is polishing rice for most Toyama prefecture breweries, and partnered with Yoshinotomo, a local sake brewery, to make Yoshinotomo sake. And they actually developed other brands such as Kiseki. Now, it's again, this was the beginning, and often the situation will evolve. In their case, interestingly enough, Yoshinotomo, in absence of a heir, was put for sale, and quite naturally, Koshi no Megumi acquired the brewery. So one brewery saved or developed with this very particular scheme.
Oh, that's cool. That's a really cool story. I like that. I like that a lot. Let's see. And I guess another really good example, as we sort of touched on a little bit earlier, was the idea of budding startups using the opportunity to build their brand ahead of the larger launch into their own production. I'd say probably the most, I don't know if it's the most notable, but one of the more high profile ones, even probably a lot of the listeners know now, would be like Wakaze, off known for the sake that they're making in France these days. They're also now making in Japan as well too, apparently, and possibly other places. They got a lot of things going on there, stuff to keep on top of. But when they originally started, they were contracting with other breweries to make them sake for an original brand that they were using to build their brand. Basically, they were using that to build their brand, build their create the income and build the market, and use what they made through that as a proof of concept for also going out and then getting funding for this project that they were, set out from the beginning. The intent from the beginning was always to set up a sake brewery in France. They were very clear about what their intents and what their long-term goals were, and that the contracting with other breweries to make the sake was a means of helping them to get there. And it worked. They've done it. They've set up the brewery in France. They've, by all accounts. They seem to have been successful and they are growing and off to new ventures and new products and other places. And so that's a great example. Ineto Agave up in Akita, when they got started, the plan was to open a brewery in Akita, close to the farmers that supported him and that he worked with. And then so early on, they were contracting using rice from the farmers that they worked with and intended to work with in Akita, together with primarily, I think it was Tsuchida Shuzo up in Gunma, to produce sake from that rice and gradually develop the brand and the type of products and the type of things they wanted to make. And lo and behold, they went and launched their brewery and so far have had all kinds of great successes and are making a lot of great product right now. And they continue to maintain the relationship that they had before, both with the farmers as well as Tsuchida Shuzo and other breweries that they worked with. So in the not so common case of a new sake brewing or sake peripheral brewing startup, this has been a means of helping get those producers off the ground.
Well, one of the reasons they do it is because they don't can't get a license, right? If you, even if you want to set up a new brewery in Japan,
Sure.
there aren't any new licenses. You can't, well, there are plenty of exceptions to this rule, but you normally can't get a new license. So,
Sure. And that's what, yeah, I mean, some reasons some places would want to contract somebody is somebody wants their own sake or wants to produce their own sake, but just does not have the means, whether it's financial or whatever reason, to get into actually setting up their own brewery. It allows them to create something. Say these scenarios were a little bit different in that, no, they couldn't necessarily easily get a sake license, but they still had found their own loophole through which they were going to set up their own operation. So these are kind of more of to help get them off the ground. It allowed them to build a market prior to actually having to make the investment to build the brewery and all those things, which adds a lot of security, knowing that you already have this, inborn market that you can, upon, making the investment to build the brewery and do those other things, that you ostensibly should be able to sell into before you actually ever spend the money and break ground on an operation of that scale. So
yeah, I think that's key. Security is definitely key. And of course, private brand sake has become a fad among the celebrity in the celebrity world, both overseas and in Japan. And sake is no exception. So there have been a number of celebrity-driven private brands in recent years. The ones that come to my mind, in fact, the first that comes to my mind, perhaps the biggest I can think of, is Foo Fighters and Ed Sheeran, both commissioned breweries to make sake for them, made a special label. And of course, in the case of Foo Fighters, it was Tata no Kawa, and they'd already done a collaboration with a French rock band a few years previous. I think it's now being facilitated by Tower Records, so it's kind of Tower Records that's kind of driving this, but
interesting, because originally it was facilitated by a I mean, if talking about Phoenix, if the rock band is Phoenix, and it was facilitated by a local sake distributor in
yes,
France
a
who
legend in
passed
France, yeah.
away. And there was a genuine love by the Phoenix group for sake that they were going to taste, and that's how I think it started.
But I believe they made the request through Tower Records. I think they have to under like a contractual type thing. So
That's
yeah.
possible.
And then Tower Records is kind of continuing this into like a series because obviously it's worked out quite good for them as well. But the other one as well, it's a little bit geeky, is some of the anime collaborations. You have like Sake, which is collaborating with famous anime like Ghost in the Shell, and that's the only one I can come off at the top of my head, but Ghost in the Shell was a big one. I know that some breweries did a collaboration with Matsumoto Reiji some years back as well. That's the guy who did the animation for Daft Punk, the band. And I want to another example I want to mention is I worked for a little while for this all you can paste bar in Tokyo, and they started off mixing regular brands, sake from the normal lineup, for the brewery's lineup, together with original products. But now they pretty much just do all original products. And what I think is a little bit unique about Garand is that they actually put an emphasis on the brewer's involvement. It's very important that the brewer is completely involved with each product. In fact, what they do is they basically ask the brewer to suggest a sake that they've always wanted to make, a style, or maybe a technique, or a rising, or an ingredient, or whatever. It basically they give the brewer an opportunity to make a sake that they've always wanted to make, but obviously, they didn't want to take the risk of producing that sake themselves. And so Karan takes on that risk. And then they get an original product out of it as well. Look, they are involved with the design process, and they do, put forward ideas as well themselves. But they're pretty much their entire lineup now is all original products. One of the reasons they do that is because they don't want to compete, obviously, with other, their competitor restaurants or shops, which maybe have the sake from the brewery's regular lineup.
Yeah, Karan's a really neat, interesting example because they worked with so many different breweries and they had so many different products and they were all original products. And then I guess on a different level, that extends out to other different restaurants, restaurant chains, or individual star chef or star sommelier places that of notoriety that work together with the producers to create, maybe something specifically for their bar or for their individual restaurant or for a smaller chain, in order to do that, to have something unique and to sort of demonstrate that relationship. And so, yeah, dining, drinking establishments, working to create original products. So definitely a big one.
Because the concepts are very clever because they've got concepts like sake which pairs with chocolate and sake which pairs with cheese and sake which is very sweet or sparkling sake. So the concept is always about kind of expanding the knowledge and appreciation of sake to a wider audience and trying to create new discoveries for existing fans as well. That's something that a lot of other restaurants and shops can easily buy into. So you're right, Justin, they are actually selling, because their parent company is actually a supplier in Tokyo. So they're an Oroshi company. So they're actually able to sell to their existing shops and restaurant
I'm curious,
clients.
but would you know how many private labels they're producing, or in the sense of act as producer or sourced?
It must be close to 100 now because
That's amazing.
they have their whole spiel is that you can taste over 100 different sake in the shop. So they must have at least 100. When I was working there, they were getting close to like 60, 50 or 60 different products. I lost track. So many. They made one which actually had crab. I think it was like mixed in, crab juice was mixed into the sake.
Really?
Yeah. Didn't appeal to me personally, but still very interesting nevertheless. And one of my favorites actually was Arinogashuzo. And they basically, there's two brothers. And one of the brothers, he doesn't normally get involved with the sake. He's more kind of a chemist. But for this particular collaboration, they invited him to come and actually get involved with the sake. So the product is called Two Brothers, Two Brothers of Science. And it's about like, they wouldn't normally work together to make sake, but for this collaboration, they did.
Yeah, the story is important, isn't it? And again, another example that comes to my mind is the Link 8888 story. And I don't want to spend too much time explaining it again because I want you, our listeners, to go back to episode 41, which is the interview of Jan Swennen, where we talk about that project at length. This is basically a cooperation between a very strong brand in the beverage sector, Chivas Regal, and a local Toyama sake brewery, Masu Izumi. And it's about leveraging on the best of both worlds. I mean, basically, what Link is, it's a sake matured in Chivas Regal casks. So, an interesting story creating a new product and and is very appealing for a new sake market, basically. It's really about playing around the Chivas Regal brand and fan base and expertise, and I mean talking about blending and aging, and bringing that to the world of sake as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think we've covered the topic as best we can, perhaps on this occasion. And it's the Wild West. It's a Wild West out there.
Episode 97, another one. Elliot Faber, I mean, producing, sourcing sake from Japan for his companies overseas.
And I guess that's worth noting. That's what you're starting to see a lot now, is a lot of this stuff is getting, or is stuff that's getting picked up for export. So you're starting to see a lot of products outside of Japan that are entirely unique labels, because they've been brought over at the request of someone, some company, and somebody's decided that they, they're going to get behind this brand, and so they're working with either a producer or a collection of producers to bring a single product or a line of products over. And you're seeing that in, in very small bespoke cases. You're also seeing it in cases of a lot more volume as well too, where you're seeing producers really dedicated to a small, narrow number of products under a certain brand to really try and fill in the market in places where there's not necessarily a lot of sake. So, like I said, there's a number of different approaches to this, and when it works well, it works beautifully. So I encourage, it's sometimes it's tough to tell where something is coming from, or exactly, what's behind all of it, or where something is made. But a lot of the stuff that seems to stick around is generally the good stuff. So, if you start seeing a lot more different types of products out there, I'd recommend giving them a try and seeing what you think, and trying to figure out where the heck it came from, and you might be able to find some more good stuff.
I often have a friend just on Facebook, just message me with a photograph of a sake that they've been drinking in a restaurant. And what is this sake? And 9 times out of 10, it's a private brand sake. It's like, oh no, I don't know what this is.
It's very common. It's very
So it's a
common.
category that's going to grow and grow and grow and grow, which is why it was so important that we needed to tackle this sooner rather than later.
We thought it was worth addressing. So, with that, we'll go ahead and call this one more episode of Sake on Air. Chris, Sebastian, thanks for aligning time zones with me this evening so that we could get this all sorted out. This took more than a few attempts to try and coordinate. So I'm glad we finally got through this.
Indeed, that have been a lot of fun.
Indeed.
Excellent. You gentlemen, take care. And to our listeners, thank you so much for tuning in to this episode of Sake on Air. If you wouldn't mind, go ahead and rate us, review us, leave a kind review, because it really, really, really helps get news about the show out into the world so that other people can learn more about sake and shochu. You can send us questions at questions@sakeonair.com, and you can follow us at Sake on Air on Instagram, X, and Facebook. And until next time, I guess we'll just have to leave it with a kanpai. We'll see y'all in a couple of weeks. And Sake on Air is made possible with the fantastic support of the Japan Sake and Shochu Makers Association, and produced by Potsuke Productions, with audio work by Mr. Frank Walter.